This program brought to you by Vanderbilt University. You can find more audio and video on our website, vanderbilt.edu/news.
All right, welcome to November 4th edition of Like a Prayer, Popular Music and Religious Identity. Tonight we are thrilled to hear from Gerald Liu, Spitting and Spirituality in Ugandan Rap Music. Is that, if I got the title right? Gerald is a PhD student in the Graduate Department of Religion in the Homiletics and Liturgics area. He's also a fellow in the Theology and Practices program. Gerald will say more about what this is all about and where this comes from, this project of his. My understanding, though, is that, Gerald, you spent, about a month and a half in Uganda as a... Was this on a Center for the Study of Religion and Culture grant? It was a grant provided by the Center for the Study of Religion and Culture. And you went with Greg Bars, as I understand it, and together, and I'll let you talk about what all that was about, and studied this music and did some interviews. The class has listened to several interviews and has listened to some of the music that you put up, I'm assuming. So let's give a round of applause and welcome Gerald Liu.
I want to say thank you for coming out on election night. I know it's kind of an awkward evening to be here. I'm going to talk for about 13 minutes, and by the way, I'm sort of experimenting. I was just telling John with Keynote, I'm sort of switching from PowerPoint to Keynote, so we'll see what happens. And then we're going to do some heavy listening for about 35, 40 minutes, if you can handle that. I might have us take a break if I feel like it's not working out. Okay. So again, I'm a second-year student in homiletics and liturgics. For those of us that don't know what those words mean, homiletics is preaching and liturgics is acts of corporate worship, often ritualized. But I'm interested in re-examining and expanding the ecclesial associations of those fields. So often those are seen as church practices. But my interest is to try to broaden what those fields mean. And I intend to do this by exploring the intersections between music and theology. I'm most interested in how individuals and groups perform and or hear music as a resource for notions of the sacred. And tonight, if we can accept a vague, colloquial sense of that term and a problematic academic one, I'd ask you to do that. And what I mean is how people come to understand cosmology, religion, belief that undergirds human connectedness or human vulnerability, and how the divine is detected through music making and or music receiving. In relation to these aims, this evening I will discuss how, with support from the Center for the Study of Religion and Culture, as well as guidance from Vanderbilt's ethnomusicologist Gregory Bars, I undertook a case study of Ugandan rap to learn and imagine how ethnomusicology, the study of music from other cultures, might relate to situating music as a theological resource. And let me say at the outset that I'll not be making any arguments in today's presentation. I will not be presenting findings that contribute to a specific set of concerns, so different from Juan Floyd Thomas's October 7th presentation, A Jihad of Words, The Evolution of African-American Islam and Contemporary Hip-Hop. I'll not be tracking any specific religious suture in Ugandan rap music. I will presume, however, that either from Professor Thomas's sharing of definitions a month ago or from your own personal knowledge of rap music, when I say things like spittin' or MC or freestyling or beat maker, someone who makes beats, you know what I mean, and you can ask me if you don't. And I want to make clear that my presentation, though certainly linked to African-American rap music, depicts a globally oriented ethnography of African hip-hop that could arguably stand on its own as a distinctive musical genre. Indeed, I have rather plain intentions of simply providing a snapshot of Ugandan hip-hop artists and their music from May to June of 2008. And I'll mainly use their own words to show how these artists understood their music as being related to what could be described as religious sensibilities or what one might call faith. Okay, first slide here. Let's see if this thing works. Is it going to work? Okay. As we may already know, Greg Bars is a pioneer of medical ethnomusicology. For those of us not in the know, what is medical ethnomusicology? In his book, Singing for Life and the accompanying CD, Professor Bars reports how NGOs, non-governmental organizations like Meeting Point, and traditional healers such as Mboni Nabanji sing songs of proclamation and perform ritualized dances that, in addition to promoting condom usage and responsible sexual ethics, also criticize the stigmatization of persons living with HIV/AIDS and offer counsel to related psychological and social strain. So he's looking at musicology, singing and dancing, and a medical spin on it, how it contributes to community healing. And last spring, I proposed to Vanderbilt Center for the Study of Religion and Culture a project where I would learn, during the month of May, field techniques from Professor Bars, while he oversaw an undergraduate learning service project called the Kampala Project, which focused on HIV/AIDS relief. And after his departure, I would spend the month of June applying my newly acquired field methods to conduct independent analysis of whether Afropop musically and religiously affects community healing and transformation analogously to the traditional music of an NGO like Meeting Point or a healer like Nabanji. Basically, I wanted to attempt a religious extension of Bars' medical ethnomusicology. What ended up happening during the months of May and June, however, was entirely different and unexpected. And before I move to the next slide, I just want to say the music we'll be hearing is not the rough cuts that I brought back from Africa. They've been mixed down by an indie local producer called Kwani Cash, so I feel like I should give him a shout out. And you can see what you think of it. But again, it sort of was like this, I guess. Our research began with the help of a local informant, Chris. Chris helped us schedule interviews with well-established and up-and-coming Afropop artists, and here are some pictures of them, most of which were Ugandan rappers. We also held numerous preliminary interviews with radio executives, such as Bettina Tumpare, who you see here, Peter Cazito, DJs Mackenzie and Wadmal from the stations such as Capital FM, Hot 100, Radio Simba, and Sanyu FM. These music industry personnel, however, gave us mixed opinions concerning the state of hip-hop in Uganda. Wadmal would speak of Ugandan MCs rapping about, quotes, HIV, highlighting social evils, you know, real issues happening in the community to separate themselves from North American artists. And he would list Luga Flow artists like Hans Toktik as shaping a new sonic awareness for local hip-hop music. Yet others like Tumpare would report that even Luga Flow MCs such as Rocky Giant, while noteworthy for his socially conscious lyrics, were not really hidden, that's how she put it. DJs were forcing the music on people. They didn't know the taste of the audience, and they just were copying and pasting Ugandan versions of American rappers. With such contrasting assessments of hip-hop in Uganda, it soon became apparent that determining any clear connection between Ugandan hip-hop, which had limited airplay and sparse public support, with widespread community and personal HIV/AIDS relief would not be an easy task. Therefore, after a conversation reviewing interviews we had conducted and calculating data we had collected on cost to record music, Barr suggested that we shift our field method approach. If the social impact of Ugandan hip-hop music would prove elusive to evaluate, what if we redirected our research agenda to a more concrete and analyzable project? Record and document a selection of Ugandan hip-hop artists representing the music from May and June 2008. So I then moved at this point from assisting Bars with an extension of his previous scholarship to assuming a role as a co-producer to compile a CD of Ugandan hip-hop music. I want to speak briefly about method at this point. We saw our investigative method as falling within the realm of experimental ethnomusicology. We would set many of the parameters that comprise the context in which the artist would craft their work and observe their creativity and process. We chose the recording studios, we paid for all studio time, we selected the artists, and we asked that the MCs write conscious music, music related to social issues. And though we were limiting the variables in the artist's music making, our method of research would not be all that different from many behavioral experiments that have tested the invention and ingenuity of subjects. In order to avoid any conflict of interest with our research funding institutions, we decided at the outset that the compilation would serve educational purposes first and foremost, and that we would not profit financially from the recordings. We agreed contractually with all artists that they would collect any proceeds should the CD become a product for sale, and thus began our exploration into producing Ugandan hip-hop. I'm going to raise some ethnographic questions and post-colonial concerns. Through a less charitable lens, our first month of producing Ugandan hip-hop tracks could be seen as manipulative or clinical in a negative Gerritsian sense. Did we assume the role of professional intruders in our research proposal? Were we outside the bounds of authentic ethnomusicology? Bars is a white male, and though I'm Asian, I'm American-born and come from the racially tarnished state of Mississippi. Did the presence of our very identities cross rather obvious ethical boundaries? Did we colonially control artistic practices within a still infant subculture of Ugandan music making? And if Tumhare, that radio executive who was female, if her evaluation of Ugandan hip-hop being copycat music of American rap is somewhat reliable, did we document simulacra? Indeed, thinkers like Kofi Agawu, Mark Slobin, and Barbara Crater, these are musicologists and ethnomusicologists, and guilds such as the American Musicological Society and the Society for Ethnomusicology, they've crafted ethical guidelines to address these kinds of concerns. Yet rather than continue in our current digression regarding ethnomusicological ethics, the intent of this presentation is not to defend the methods that Bars and I adopted, but rather I want to reveal them, and I want to raise possible concerns, albeit without offering any argument as to how you, the listener, should situate yourself with regards to our methodology and my specific project of investigating religion in Ugandan hip-hop music. Acknowledging and suspending these post-colonial and ethical issues so that we can perhaps engage them in detail later, I'll now shift to discussing the second and primary focus of my research in Kampala, investigating whether the hip-hop artists we recorded had religious commitments or faith claims, and inquiring whether and to what extent such claims and commitments influenced their musical craft. So a bit about the album. Bars departed Kampala at the end of May, and by this time we had purchased two tracks. Lyrical G's I'm From Where, which was an English track done by a two-time Pearl of Africa Award winner. It's like a African Grammy. And Kampala Mbuza, which is in Luga Flow, which means it uses the language of Uganda, by an artist named Zenson. And then we had 11 other tracks that we actually co-produced, and I'm just going to list them. They're in alpha order by artist, and then they give the title of the track and translation if needed, and the language. But I'm not going to say them all. And you can see we tried to have a mix of English and African languages, even with Swahili, which isn't natively spoken in Uganda. And we also tried to have female artists as well. So you can see Chilla at number 7 and Tafash at number 10. Following the departure of Bars, I also recorded 2 tracks independently. One of them was Igwak Akan Kalkuju, which means keep your head up. This was done in the northern dialects of Acholi and Ateso by Ralph Ammon Lumix. And then another track by a female MC called Man's Lady, which we heard at the beginning of this presentation. During the time of independent research, I also conducted exit interviews with all artists, beat makers, and sound producers involved in the making of the compilation. I first asked them to review and comment upon their contribution, and then I would ask about a religious reference from a lyric, or inquire if they considered themselves to be religious. And I would follow this line of questioning by asking if they linked their music making to their religion or faith. Let me make clear that none of the artists chosen for the initial recording of the compilation were known to have religious commitments or faith claims, and not until the month of June did the artists know that I would be conducting exit interviews regarding their theological or spiritual outlooks and whether these perspectives affected their music making. Neither did the artists know that I was a graduate student in homiletics and liturgics or associated with theology at all. And yet, surprisingly, every artist that Bars and I recorded, with the exception of Zenson, who I couldn't reach at the end, expressed some type of religious connection, and most linked their religion as a root for their musical craft. So let's now hear from the artists. We're going to go into an extended period of listening, and again, if I see your eyes glaze over, we might take a break and get questions.
Another problem we are facing here, like female MCs, girl MCs, many girls fear to get on stage because of the names which are going to be called, I mean, by the guys or by the crowd, or everywhere they go.
Give me an example of the names.
No matter what language. Okay. Here in Uganda, like a prostitute.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, prostitute. They call them malayas.
Malayas.
Yeah. Only malaya. Like I'm on stage, somebody calls you, yeah, malaya, checho, something like that. And another thing, when you're a woman and you're on stage, like busy rapping, they call you a dova, like somebody who smokes weed. We call them Ugandans. Another thing, that you're a whole hooker, something like that. They take you something who is stubborn, who is of the world. I mean, they take us like girls who are living in our own world, which is not true. We are human and we are normal people like they are. That's another thing why female MCs are scared to get on stage. Yeah. Yeah, in Uganda.
All right. How do you feel about that?
To me, it's normal. I just admit, as long as I know whatever they're talking about me, whatever they're calling me, it's not what I do. I know what it means to me. I know everything I do, because I do it because of love of it. I have love for it.
So what do you want to do for the women in Uganda?
For the women? Actually, the advice, I just have to advise them. Let them forget about what people say. Let them just keep a low profile. Let them just come, do their things on stage. Show people what you have. And you have to admit whatever they call you, as long as you know yourself, you're not doing it. But if you don't, if you're doing it, I mean, have nothing for you. But if you know yourself that you are not doing it, man, you better come and show us what you got, because we are missing female MCs in the country. That's the reason why maybe they're saying hip-hop is not here yet, but hip-hop is here. So female MCs, wherever you are, whether you're there, whether you're interested in music, or if you fear the stage, come and talk to Twiggy. I'll be there for you. I'll give you a hand, and we'll do it together as one.
All right.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. Chain, no difference. Yeah.
What about your role in Uganda? How long have you been doing this?
Yeah, okay. I've been in the game for just 2 years. Yeah, I've been in the game for 2 years.
Are you from Kampala?
Yeah, I'm from here.
How did you get started?
I was inspired by a guy at the church, because I used to go at KBC church, so I used to sing, as well as I used to like hip-hop. So I wrote a bit of hip-hop, so I went to church. That's when I got to meet a guy called Proper. So Proper was like, we talked a little, and it was like, yeah, you can do something in hip-hop. So we need girls, we need women, MCs in UG. So, I mean, if you can change, do your gospel. He didn't stop me, but it was like, you can rap, you can do something.
What music?
It's a church.
What does it stand for?
Kampala Catholic Church, KBC, People's Church, okay. Something like that.
All right, okay.
Yeah.
So, you started rapping in the church?
Yeah, in the church.
That
was way back in 1999.
Okay.
Yeah.
How long have you been at that church?
Now, I've been there. But I left the church, but now, yeah, I'm no longer there. I no longer go to perform there. I perform in a different church now.
What
going
church
back.
Do you perform in now?
Bethan Church.
Bethan Church?
Yeah, Bethan Church.
Entebbe.
Yeah.
So, you consider yourself a person of faith?
Yeah?
Yeah. Can you tell me what that means to you? Describe it for me.
Okay. It means a lot. To me, a person of faith, I mean, I have to trust myself in the first place.
Okay.
And that means if I trust myself, I trust God, everything I do, I mean, I do it for myself and I do it for people, as well as God is there, everything of mine, I need to be straight.
Okay.
Yeah, I need to be straight. So that's the reason why I put this faith in me. I don't want to lie. I don't want to do anything, but I just want to be straight.
Okay.
Yeah. Because, I mean, if I didn't have God in me, I think I would have been this crazy girl on the planet. Yeah, but just because I have someone who is guiding me and listen to my heart, that's the reason why I have this. Yeah.
Does your faith have a name? Or is it
a
just...
A name, like...
Like... Islam or Judaism or
no
okay.
Yeah,
all right. Does it affect your music making at all?
Actually, no, it doesn't.
So
it has none at all. I just love it that way, because whenever I think about something, yeah, it must be straight. Yeah.
So your faith doesn't play a part in the way you make music?
It plays, of course, it has to be there, because, I mean, I can't just sit there like I'm writing about this without faith. I mean, I have to think first before I write something and ask God, is this right? Do I have to do this? So if I didn't have that, maybe I would have been somewhere, or I wouldn't have been doing this. Just because I have faith, I believe in me, I believe in everything I do.
So every time you spit, it's for God.
Sometimes. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
When you write.
But you notice the sophistication of the answer. There's so many reversals, and that's why I don't want to evaluate what they're saying. So I just want to put it out there for you.
I think I consider myself more of a spiritual being than a religious person. I mean, I don't practice any particular religion at the moment, but I'm still searching. My spirit is still searching for the right, you know, the right meaning and purpose in my life.
Now, the track you just heard has kind of a moral message to it. Does your search for spirituality affect your music making?
Yeah, because I believe in a higher power. I believe in God. You know, I believe that things aren't, you know, things are the way they are for a reason. You know, it's not just some accidental stuff that, you know, bad luck or good luck. You know, I believe that stuff is the way it is. It's designed that way. So it does affect my music because I feel like people have a moral obligation to their spirit, you know, and to their soul and to humanity to be as human as it can possibly be, you know, and try and not overlook the circumstances of people in Africa and people that are struggling. So it does affect my music because I sing a lot about that.
How does it relate specifically to the chorus of Mourn? Or does it?
Communicating to again?
To me and maybe students, graduate students.
Well, I'd like for people to know that people to know that there's a new kind of African that's emerging, you know, not just through music, but a lot of things. An African that's embracing their past and as well as trying to hold on to the future and trying to make their mark on the world, not become an extinct group of people that were just good at fighting each other and, you know, and being hungry all the time. So I'd like for people to know that and hopefully be able to support and encourage this kind of, the kind of music that I make.
One last question. How does the new African relate to the African American?
Yeah. That's a funny question because my friend, I was just with her a few hours ago. She's African American, and we have a, you know, we sit for hours trying to, you know, dissect our cultures and see what's. I don't think we relate much, you know, honestly. Yeah, I think the African American has really been isolated from any and everything that's African, to the point that he can't even mirror himself or ourselves in African culture and identity. I mean, the skin color is the same, you know, and possibly a lot of mannerisms and habits are the same, but in terms of relating, it's really difficult because most of the African Americans I've spoken with are very unaware of what's happening in Africa. They take most of the information that they know about the world from television, which doesn't provide much information. And those that do get information outside of that aren't exactly willing to come down here to Africa and see what exactly is going on and be foot soldiers in trying to make a change. So I think it all starts with the media, you know, mass education. I feel the United States education system is also lacking, you know, they kind of just sugarcoat a lot of things and keep them behind, you know, behind covers, and people don't really get to know much about it. So most of the African Americans I come across are like, oh, there's monkeys in Africa, you guys are living in huts, you know, there's no schools there, that's why you're out here in the U.S. trying to get an education. And I'm like, no, actually, it's, you know, we're developing, we're becoming stronger and stronger every day. I mean, we may have been the way we're portrayed in the media like 50 years ago, but we're not that way anymore. And it would be good if you can get some of your passion and energy and contribute it towards Africa's development, because we need to unite as a people, not just because of our skin color, but because of our background and our history and, you know, trying to create a better future for our children.
I
want to
continue just a little bit further.
Yeah.
I know I said it was
yeah.
There's this theme of responsibility from the U.S. towards Africa.
Yeah.
But is there a responsibility for the new African towards the African American specifically?
Wow, that's a good question. I have only witnessed anything close to that in West Africa, you know. A lot of West Africans are very, this is East Africa, you know, but in West Africa, it's sort of, they have an idea of a lot more knowledge about slavery and their past and history, and they're very much more connected to it because it affected them way, way more than the East Africans. With East Africans, they're not really generally aware of most of these things. It's just what you learn in school, and that's about it. You know, so they don't feel like, you know, it's the U.S. Not quite. No, not really. The U.S. is like miles and miles and miles away. So people in Uganda specifically don't even think about stuff like that. But I'd say in general, the African is more aware of, you know, their past and history. And I've witnessed in West Africa people trying to connect and reach out to African Americans. I was watching a documentary in the BBC where they were bringing in groups of African Americans to Ghana and to Senegal to learn about their history and walk through the slave trade routes and, you know, and go to the island of No Return and all those places where slaves were really, you know, so they can connect to it and try to be a part of it. And they're inviting them in and, you know, making the economy more open towards them and investment and stuff. I do. Yes, I do. And that's why I think that's one of the reasons why I make music. You know, that's not just appealing to Africans. I try to make it appealing to, you know, this element of I make hip hop, you know, elements of African American music in my music. And that's not accidental. That's because I want them to be more aware of the wholesomeness of who we are as Black people, you know, the wholesomeness of our cultures, how music originated in Africa, and how we need to keep it. Okay, lots of forms of music originated in Africa, like blues, you know, which later evolved into rock and roll, which later evolved into jazz and other forms, and now it's modern music, you know, and we listen to it on the radio and gyrate and shake to it, you know. But, you know, looking back, you know, I personally would say to African Americans not to just keep being trend makers, you know, and just grab a trend, go with it, abandon everything else, you know, and let other people take care of that, you know. They should actually embrace everything that's a part of their history, including Africans as well. And, you know, hopefully that way we can move together and create a force that's bigger and, you know, more powerful.
Final words again?
No, I think that's pretty much that it.
More counsel for those supposed to be young soldiers, cause they have to learn to live a life that is sober. More men be fathers, more women be mothers, more grown-ups be faithful to their partners. More about the gospel, more teaching from the right chapters, more talks about the life after. Cause with all this promiscuity, everyone seems to have forgotten about HIV. Because of that, more people are going to fall instead of having more of our own standing tall. More.
Why you keep on walking and walking away?
I guess, to all intents and purposes, I am Christian-ish. No, I believe in God. I believe in Jesus. Yeah. I believe in getting saved, but I have very little faith in churches.
Why is that?
Because churches are man-made institutions which always end up being corrupted. There's no church that has failed to become corrupted. Look at history. Find me a church that has failed sooner or later to be corrupted. Yeah. Churches are too involved with money, and money corrupts at the end of the day. That's why, when you see, when I do my music, remember when you first asked me to do this, I think, is this about the money or is it about hip-hop? If you had said you can make some money doing this, I probably would have said no. Yeah, I would have said no. But this is like, it was a hip-hop project that, you know, boosted hip-hop. That's what was my concern. Boost hip-hop. Do stuff that is useful.
That's meaningful.
Yeah. Serious phases, though.
Yeah. And do you think, even in the more overtly religious tracks or the more veiled ones, like the ones with the liturgy most recently, does your faith play a part in your production?
You see, that's where it becomes difficult, because for me, I see my talent as coming from God. It's a God-given gift. Yeah, if God chose to borrow that I was not worth this gift, then I would make crap. Yeah, for the rest of my life. It's basic. It's not up to me. This gift. It's up to God. That's the way I see it. So I don't know if my faith plays a big role in what I do, or what I do plays a big role in my faith. Yeah, it's kind of the chicken and the egg sort of thing.
Yeah. Mm. Any last words?
I'll be back.
I love it.
You're far from cold, you've been itching, screaming and plotting to make a killing. I seen you in a classroom, but I doubt that you've been reading. Your body is a temple of God, gotta respect that. But your eyes on the prize, nice phone and nice girl, check that. You need to hold up and watch yourself. Sold your mind, body, but soul, now ask yourself if it was worth it, the riches for sex, the feelings you trade to acquire good breaths. Got me thinking you fake, and that's the shame about what's happened to the youth of the day. You went from a sweet little girl, but now you're a slave. You're sent down enough to be the mother of the world. You can't be going out just so you can have a good time. Hard done, always taking in and out of the hospital, regretting why you messed up your life. How's that possible?
You wanted something for something, something for something.
But in the end, you got nothing for something.
You wanted something for something, something for something.
But in the end, you got nothing for something.
Let's think of how I'd put it in a hip-hop way, you know, to deliver it in a hip-hop way. That's why I'll tell people. So, because most people ask me, hey, you're a Rasta, how come you don't do reggae? I'm like, yeah, I love reggae, I respect reggae, but I bring my reggae in a hip-hop style, because reggae is about, reggae music is delivering, it's all about the messages, it's the message in the music. So I deliver it in a hip-hop style, you know. So reggae to me is just like a style, you know, of music. Yeah. That's why you call it R&B, reggae, hip hop. Yeah, so maybe do it in a the hip hop style, but it's reggae, it's conscious music.
So you think Mama and Kimbuti,
yeah, sure,
show your Rastafarianism?
True that. Yeah, it does. Because like Mama, you know, I'm talking about the love for Mama. I'm talking about Mama, the love for Mama, the respect for Mama. And those are basically what Rastafarianism asks you to do. You know, you respect your Mama. You know, even that there's a part I was like, you know, in the song of the part, like, even for fire, Mwishimu Mama, Mtunze Mama, Yendo Kiyucha Jamii, you know, like that part I was trying to tell the man, you know, because. You know, basically, am I talking a lot?
No, it's good.
It's like.
Okay, tell me what you say to God.
Always tell God, please, God, yeah? Man, I know, you give me that this life every day. I mean, you always want me to do this and this for you, but I never do them, like, pray 5 times a day because I'm a Muslim. But at the end of the day, man, you know, I always, I mean, you're the one, I know you're the one who gives us this life and everything. Please help me. Please make change, bring changes in my life, man. Okay, like right now, I got plans of like going to UK. That's like my greatest dream. I want to get there. I always ask God, please make me be famous, you know, and please let me live. I always tell God, man, I need to live large. I also want to drive cars. I want to live in a mansion, something like that, man. I want to help people, man. I don't want to be helped all the time. Let me be the one to help, man. And I always tell God, man, no matter what I do, man, please forgive me. Please forgive me. And I know that I love you and I know you're there for me, but please consider me, you know? That's how I talk to you. That's what I know. Because, like, man, it's not getting out of hand, you know? Kind of.
Media ukimwi na ukimwi ndio mimi wananiita hatari cause hawakuwa tayari na kuja vibaya shida accident ya gari na kucheza kaka mavi na fresh shida habari na leta worries nikitokea huwezi niona nikikushika huwezi nipona wengi hawaamini kuwa niko mimi ni moto shinda jiko wanani take so simple wanadhani mimi ni pimple wananiimba kajigo mimi ni illegal wameniadvertise mpaka kwa billboard ukimwi mimi ni hatari kwa maisha yako usiclaim vako ukimwi mimi ni hatari kwa maisha yako usiclaim vako huwezi jua labda niko dawa ni kupima ukimwi mimi ni hatari kwa maisha yako usiclaim vako ukimwi mini hatari kwa maisha yako usile mbako uwezi jua labda niko dawa ni kupima napendaka sana wajinga
philosopher I devote my whole life to learn rather than have fun living on the brink of danger like I run my country needs me nese kwetaga nawe kwetaga so I use it as it will draw a clearer picture.
Do we need a break by the way before I go on? We're at 40 minutes. We've got about 12 left. No? Okay.
Philosopher, I devote my whole life to learn rather than have fun. Living on the brink of danger like I run. My country needs me. Nese kwetaga, nawe kwetaga. So I used it as it would draw a clearer picture. Muhammad was all about positivity in faith and God, but it was all about morality. I'm trying to read it.
You're trying to read
it? I'm trying to read it. I'm a Christian myself, but I'm trying to read it.
Why are you trying to read it?
Should I say self-discovery? You know, there have been like so many doubts about literature and theology. So you like really want to find out the truth. You find so many similarities and so many different beliefs. You find they all believe in one God. And then you have Christians also believing in one God. They also consider Jesus having been a prophet. So I'm trying to find out for myself where the difference is. God created us like this other sense of reasoning. So they didn't give us that reasoning as a mistake. God doesn't make mistakes. Your eyes are put on the head probably. They wouldn't have been put on the toes because you wouldn't have been able to see that far if they were on the toes. So your reasoning is also there for a reason. So this other free will, I'm trying to use it in a way of finding truth in myself, to find truth for myself. Who is God? And things like that.
But who is God for you?
And who is God for me? Actually, I would like to say that right now, honestly, speaking to you honestly, I would say I'm a little bit confused. I'm confused, yeah. I know that even for a house to exist, it has to have someone who has to have built it, yeah? And then you have people talking about a revolution. I don't honestly believe in revolution and the Charles Darwin doctrine and stuff like that, but I believe that there's a higher being on everything because usually you have that other voice calling behind your shoulder, telling you when you're about to do something wrong, you always hear that consciousness calling. Yeah. My other side of trying to find out the truth from religion and what I'm beginning to like discover is I don't know how to put this without being blasphemous, but there's some kind of bit of unfairness unfairness of God? Yeah, no. The way God is portrayed is somehow unfair.
Okay, what do you mean by that?
Look at the situation we're in right now, where we have, everybody, you have your parents. If your parents were Khadija and Zainab, you would be probably an Ismail, yeah? And you would be strongly believing in the Quran. They would teach you that the ways of Christianity are all wrong. And if I were produced a Buddhist, I would be made to believe, live in harmony with the plants and blah, blah, don't do wrong. You'll find God in that, yeah? And you also have people who are raised as Christians. They all look at the Muslims as evil people, fanatics and blah, blah, you get? So I'm saying, when we all get to heaven and we've all been made to believe, they teach you, in so many religious sects, they teach you that this is the only way. What about the other people who have been raised in so many other religions? And isn't there heaven for them? Isn't there God for them? So those are the questions that keep going through my head. I don't believe in something wrong. I always want to find out the truth and then follow the truth, find the truth for myself. And there's something I always refer to, like, remember the people that God always picked out, like in the Bible? Not all of them were saints.
Right.
Not all of them, or most of them. Noah, the person who built the ark, was a village drunkard.
Right.
But he chose Noah, the village drunkard. And he showed him the truth. Then you have Abraham. Abraham did a little searching for himself. True? But he was living in the city where they were worshipping so many other gods. He reached an extent where he said, God, reveal yourself to me. Then you have Saul. It wasn't Saul himself who changed, it was God who made him change. Saul to Paul. After being blind and persecuting so many other people. So I'm looking at all this and I'm like, probably through knowledge and searching so many other things, God will find me. It's the truth that I'm feeling for.
So you think God will find you?
Yeah, I think so.
I first pray about it. I say, Lord, you know, this is not me, this is not what I want, but I'm just doing the job, I'm on job, so pop. I will not be seen as, you know, someone who's diverting from faith. So really, I pray every day with every work that I'm going to. Every day that I come here, I pray. Because I know this is not a Christian, you know, Christian studio.
Right.
Yeah, and Jika always wants me to be around.
Comparison with gospel music.
Yeah.
Gospel music has a message. What is the message of hip hop or your hip hop?
Why I relate to them is because, you know, in hip hop, it's kind of abnormal for one to start like dancing to it. You get it's so unheard of to dance in hip hop, because when you listen to hip hop, it's something that you have to put in your night, in your head, like, you get. Now, for gospel music, it happens to be the same. You have to, there's something that you have to pick out of like the track, you get. So that's how the two get to be related.
Now, do you consider yourself religious or have a faith?
Yeah, I do have a faith.
Can you describe it for me?
Yeah, I'm Catholic, but in a way, I feel like hip-hop is more religious to me. In a way, I just feel like it's a religion. I'm kind of binded to it. You get?
Okay.
If you look at KRS-One and the way, and the whole hip-hop perspective it has, you get? So I feel like that's how stuff should be.
Right
now, KRS-One has got the Ten Commandments of hip-hop, which is cool, on the temple of hip-hop, which is cool. I mean, it guides the whole hip-hop industry.
Does your faith or your religion influence your music making?
Not much.
Not much?
Not much.
All right.
Yeah, because my music is mostly like what I've gone through as me, you get?
I feel
yeah, it's not from the Bible, it's not from... It's basically me, you get? And maybe some other people that are going through the same stuff. So that maybe my music can help calm them down, you get? So when they reach somewhere and they're like, oh, this guy, Rob Farmer, has passed through this, then I can persevere this and be this, you get, not just giving up in a way.
Can you freestyle for me?
Yeah, I can.
Hang on just a second.
You got a translation. I don't know if you'll be able to see it in the slide. But it's just the first, the third verse, and the chorus.
When you looked at her, the time she was in hospital, on the hospital bed, she looked so bad. You actually never thought she would survive. You get, so even if praying is not your thing, at least for her and the relationship that you have for her, at that time you could humble yourself down and be like, huh?
So you prayed for her?
Yeah, I did. I prayed for her. Yeah, I prayed for her. And I'm so proud she cured. Yeah, I'm so proud she cured.
God was in that?
Yeah, he was, because by the way she looked, at least if you never thought God exists, for that time you had to believe it, because at least I saw it with my eyes. I had no hope. By the end of the day, she was fine. She actually had her pelvic bones, all the lost position, the arms, the legs. She was just lying on the bed. By the end of the day, she can still walk, though she's not so stable.
What do you mean by this? That's why I chose to preach about the problems. What
does
the MC preach?
The MC basically preaches what goes on in society, what he's living, you get. And I think he's more of like a practical preacher, I would say. Because he can't come up and just talk what he's not going through.
What about you, Lamexa? What about yourself?
You know, here, basically, if your family is Catholic, you're supposed to be Catholic. So I'm Catholic.
What does it mean to be Catholic for you?
To me, that doesn't really mean a lot. I want to be in the church for some time, not because I don't believe in what they say, because they have some really good teachings out there, but I think I could get better teaching from hip-hop music than the church at the
because
moment. So,
hip-hop is a Catholic
so it's so I listen to more music than going to church, really.
So you don't think your Catholic faith features in your music in any kind of way?
No, it does not. Because I'm in the real world. The real world has a lot of people. It doesn't have religious people. It doesn't have so just people surviving. So basically, the faith doesn't make really big sense.
All right.
Yeah.
Aha.
I'll open it up for questions real quick, and I want to pose two to maybe get or not. Go ahead.
I guess two things. One, after hearing some of these songs, it sounds like the indigenous languages seem, there's something about the beats that make them more, it hits my ear in a, like a not as aesthetically pleasing way when there's African beats and English lyrics. It seems like there's a greater synergy, and I just wanted to bring that idea up. But also, and I guess my bigger question is, like in Noise and Spirit, Anthony Penn's work on rap music and hip hop, he delineates three different types of rap, or whatever, which we could take this as those two, but they're like conscious, machismo, and gangster. And it sounded like, of all this, most of it would fall into the conscious kind of. And my question is there a gangster rap equivalent going on there? Like, is there sexism or misogyny at work, or like laudation of like violence and things like that happening in any of, with any of these artists, or just in general?
Yeah, there certainly is. You are in John's class, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So there was a master's class that got sort of much longer, the full interviews.
Yeah.
And in one of those, one of the rappers talks about club tracks. I don't know if you remember that being mentioned at all. But those club tracks would have machismo in it. Not so much gangsta themes, because the Ugandans want to separate themselves as a genre from North American artists. And they sort of see that as actually hurting the popularity of rap in Uganda, because it's not a very widely listened to music, in the sense that you might hear, you know, Kanye West on the radio there, but you won't hear someone like Easy Tex, who was the last person we heard on the radio, because local rap is still kind of a burgeoning market. And they think the reason for that is that Ugandan people associate rap with violence, and they actually don't want to hear that. And I think we can sort of guess at why that might be, but I would imagine it's because the context already has so much violence there. There's an AIDS crisis, so people don't want to hear this in their music. They don't find that cathartic in the same way that maybe urban artists in this country would. But they do have machismo, and there's references to sexuality and female body parts and all kinds of things like that. So,
Joe, could you say anything more about the sort of, you know, Dawu talks about the difference between, he says, my stuff is not clubby, and then he uses the word chemical. What exactly, do you have any clues about what exactly he's driving? I mean, he uses the word experimental a little bit behind that, but it's hard to know. Does that play into the sort of conscious genre in some way?
I think what he's describing more there is his own particular approach to producing. Right, the organic nature of the way in which tracks are made in his studio. And I'm not sure that he's making any larger philosophical claim than that.
That clarifies for me. I just thought it dovetailed on that comment a little bit, because I couldn't figure it out.
But if you remember Twig, that female we first heard talking about female MCs, and she was saying, you know, they call us Malaya prostitutes.
Right,
so that's coming from other rappers. So it's definitely there in the culture.
About the kind of fan base, I was kind of, when one of your pics, one of the images up there, you know, we see this big stage, and I just kind of want to get a better grasp of, like, I mean, is this sort of a grassroots thing, meaning there's like thousands of people, or hundreds of thousands, or hundreds
Yeah, a lot of those stage shots were from a club called Sabrina's that we would frequent every week. They had a hip-hop night on Tuesday nights, as a matter of fact. And a lot of the MCs would come out there to sort of test their skills or up-and-comers. It was like a writer's night, basically. Some nights there'd be, I'd say, anywhere from maybe 60 to 80, and other nights there would be 10 folks in the audience. So it was very unpredictable. But supposedly the Raw Fam and Lumix track, I don't know if you remember, it was in the northern dialects of Acholi and Oteso. Lumix says in Gulu, which is the northern part of the country, he says he's sold 60,000 albums, which is unimaginable in a Ugandan market. And he says he's actually had more success in the northern part because he raps in that dialect, and it wouldn't be possible to do that in Kampala. The music that's popular in Kampala City is something like reggae dance hall music. I don't have any on me, but I don't think we'd find it all that appealing, to be honest.
Now, when you say albums, do you really talk about albums?
Uh-huh. Little CDs, yeah. But they're not sold in something like FYE, is that the record shop on West End? In fact, Greg and I, before, when we were trying to sort out or get a comprehensive view of what the scene was like in Kampala, we went to a record shop, and we could only find one hip-hop album on the shelves. But it should be said that most music is not sold through stores. It's street vendors sort of hawk them, and that's the way it's passed along. And, of course, there's no downloading culture because the bandwidth is way too slow. To give you an idea, I helped one of our informants download iTunes on his computer. It took 4 hours. We just sat in a bar with Wi-Fi for 4 hours. So.
Back to how you were saying it was more popular for him in Gulu and stuff. Is that because of political things like the LRA and stuff that's gone up there, would you say? Or?
Again, this is where there's a lot of critique to be made in the way in which we produced the album, because we asked the artists to write conscious music. Now, if you just picked up their normal recordings, there might be a track or two, but very few of them are going to mention the LRA, the Lord's Resistance Army, in a line. They might do it in a song, but they don't sort of formulate their musical identity around addressing those kind of political issues. And I would guess that that's not the reason why he was popular in the North. It's more that he's rapping in that particular language, and he's skilled at producing beats that people want to buy. So, yes.
You briefly mentioned something about post-colonialism. Throughout the videos, I kept noticing in the background when you were interviewing them, British TV, Coldplay.
Uh huh. Yeah. Right.
And how much do you feel like that still kind of imperialist connection is there and driving and controlling them musically?
Yeah, that's a great question. Take, for example, the way in which they were describing their religious commitments. For the most part, it was all monotheistic. And some of it was downright evangelical. Now, are those traces of empire? You know, because Uganda was a British colony, are those words sort of traces of that kind of history? I wasn't there long enough to know. And then I think in terms of, do we just say, oh, they're permeated by Western culture? That's a little unfair. And the way I want to challenge that is the beginning question of when the radio executives were arguing over whether Ugandan rap was distinct from American rap. The rappers themselves would say, actually, rap has always been African. And they'll say, I can think of a traditional practice called Kahundra, where a male would rhyme to the father of a woman in order to win her as a bride. This tradition is centuries old. And so they would say, actually, something like Kahundra was brought through the Middle Passage, became rap music in the Bronx centuries later, and then came back to Africa. So certainly there are post-colonial concerns, but I think there's the syncretism is tricky to get at and to say, well, what is from the West, what's truly African, or is this just a new phenomenon all to itself? I don't think we can clearly critique either way. Because who's to say listening to Coldplay isn't a Ugandan thing to do? I mean,
you know, one thing, Gerald, that I was struck with by GNL's the piece that you gave us to listen to, and that we listened to here again, where he paints a picture of himself reading the scriptures on his own. Not just one set of scriptures, but, you know, several sets of scriptures. A difficult task, and you kind of said, you know, you kind of pushed him on it a little bit, and he said, I'm trying to read it, you know. And then he moves on, and then he gets further down, and he says, honestly, I'm confused, you know, when you ask him. He talks about his faith, and then he goes into this really poignant section about the unfairness that he experiences in God. Saying the unfairness of God, he kind of goes that direction, but his initial statement is this unfairness in God, that we somehow and this unfairness becomes his picture, if you will, of the human condition and of evil to some extent, that we all assume one way and we don't allow for other ways to exist and so on. But there's several issues in that for me, but the one that struck me when I heard it again tonight was that he's kind of on his own. I come back to the original thing of reading these scriptures on his own. So I wondered how do these fairly religious individuals resource themselves or resource each other? Are there communities of conversation? Did you see any? Did they talk at all about who other than other listening to other musicians? Who they talk with about questions such as this or issues? Well. There were several pieces of poignancy in what he was saying, but that one struck me. Just, you know, who does he talk with?
Mm-hmm. I think there are different registers depending upon the artist. So, for example, one of the last interviews we heard was Lumix talking about Catholicism, and he says, "Well, my family's Catholic, so I'm Catholic." And that's going to be his primary conversation partner, maybe not one he's listening to all that much. And then we began with Twig saying, you know, how did you get into the game? How did you begin rapping? And she said, well, I began in the church. The church provided me the space. Someone like GNL, even though he's not yet has his feet on the ground in terms of determining what the lay of the land of his religious commitments he's in conversation with the culture around him, right? And specifically a Pan-African one. So he says, if you're Hadija or Zaina, then you're going to be Ishmael. You're going to be a Muslim. Hadija is sort of a Muslim region in Nigeria, I think. But so this is sort of what he's bouncing his ideas off of. But it is an isolated quest for him, and the reason why I chose that interview segment is because I feel like it resonates with maybe students here or in religious studies in general. But the irony is that in his quest for self-discovery, at the end he thinks God will find him, right? He said, well, God will find me. So for all the effort that I put forth, there's this faith on his part that God will discover who he is. But he's also a university student. I mean, he's very well educated. I think he studied environmental science, and he does technical writing for environmental companies as his day job, and then he is GNL, you know, at night.
So.
Yes, right.
Yes.
Oh, I was just going to ask, could you repeat that quote that you just said?
Well, he says that, this is probably, I don't know if you played it, but he says, at the end of his section, he said, the way that I wrote it down was, he said, after he says that he thinks that God will find me, because God is fair, by the way, he actually comes back and he...
There's all these interesting reversals,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, wonderful, very sophisticated, I think you're right.
So Twig says, no, my faith doesn't play a part in my music making. Oh, of course it does, you know.
Right,
of course
it comes back and reverses it. But then he talks about what he prays for. He says, I pray every time before recording to the God who created me. This is who he prays to. And he says that that God would let me be created. At the highest level of self-expression, you achieve G&L, greatness with no limit. That was at the end of it. I mean, these, I was just kind of taking some of the quotes down. But these are really... I think it's just fascinating for our class to see what happens when you interview artists. I mean, we've been doing a lot of fan study stuff. We talked interviewing fans, and then we looked at the texts. You know, one of the real wonderful gifts of what you have brought to us is that we get to see what happens when you go and talk to the artists, the producers, the engineers, those who are on the sort of production end of it. It's not something that we've encountered even in our readings.
Yeah, and what I've tried to push is what happens when you take them on their own terms. So, you know, I'm not thinking, oh, he doesn't know what the hell he's talking about. I'm just nodding and saying, okay.
Yeah. Any other questions for Gerald?
Well, I found it fascinating. Is it Tishla?
Shilla.
Shilla.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's who it was. I took some notes while I was listening, but... she's talking about the New African, and you ask, how does the New African relate to the African American? And then she says that she doesn't think they relate much. It's difficult, and that she thinks the African Americans are unaware of what's happening in Africa. And then she calls on African Americans to devote their energy to what is happening in Africa. And I'm just curious with my African American friends in the room. Because you played some of that on your kind of montage, like how do you relate to that? Like, what does that mean? Like, I found that kind of fascinating. And then too, she kind of, in a sense, is an assault on American education and that we sugarcoat kind of what's happening in Africa. And I'm just curious to everyone in the room, what we think about that. Is that true? What can be done about that?
Or not sugarcoat it, but make it saltier than it really is, right? She says, there's a new African. We're not all starving. And again, part of the agenda here, and I'll shut up, is to say, we often think of Africa as a place to go and help folks, but here they're offering something to us, this aesthetic. So, but I don't know. What do we think of Claire's question?
I think it just speaks to some of the historical tension between Africans and African Americans that always exists. Sometimes there is, I found, and sometimes it's too stereotypical also. I think generalizations are too great, are too broad to try to negotiate a relationship and describe the relationship also, which I preface my statement with. But sometimes there is a tendency for Africans to, for some Africans to believe that, A, African Americans do not have a culture. I've heard that several times. And if you listen in the clip where she said, you know, there's no resonance in African Americans to their cultural identity in African Americans, I think that's a far cry, a little bit over exaggeration, quite a bit of exaggeration when she says, you know, their tendencies or things, but they, you know, they don't relate them back to African culture. At the same time, especially in the comment about American education, the educational system, and just media, popular culture, and all, but with the picture of Africa's pan, I think there's great work that needs to be done there. As someone who has been to Africa and sees the difference, that there's a great gap between what we learn. As Gerald said, yeah, it needs to be saltier. The educational system needs to be saltier. The media needs to be saltier. Save that we need to paint a different picture and really captivate some of the things that are going on. On the same flip side, that I think some African Americans would say, you know, that because of history, because of the disconnect, because of slavery in this country, because the reality of our history, there is a disconnect between African Americans and Africans in that way. But in the same time, that there needs to be recognized that there is a great African American culture here. There is something about thriving in this country. You know, there's a history and tradition there that often goes unrecognized on behalf of some Africans about African American culture and community.
I'll say that as well, in addition. Them very well, actually, but also just within the African diaspora, I would say, and the Caribbean as well, I think there's a difference in how African Americans are looked at as far as, you know, those that are within the African diaspora, specifically in the Caribbean as well, and that African Americans may or may not have a culture of their own, and I think Lisa touched on that as far as the African side, but even, like I said, further in the diaspora, also in the Caribbean, there's, you know, that disconnect as well. And I think from what I saw, at least in my experience, that some of it has to do with the demographic that's present there, you know, that whereas, you know, in Africa, you know, you're part of the majority. And the Caribbean, to a certain degree, you're part of some kind of majority. In the United States, you're part of a quote-unquote minority. And so there's also that piece to it as well. And so I think, you know, also there's a piece where some African Americans are kind of tapped into that culture, that a more Afrocentric identity, I guess. And I know I can only speak for myself and probably the perspective from my family and my friends, but, you know, going to an HBCU, a historically black college university. My mother going there, my aunt going, and a lot of other family members. So having a certain perspective as well from that experience, that piece plays a lot into it as well. But I think in the greater diaspora, especially not within the United States and also within Western Europe, I will say that there is a sort of disconnect, but of course our identities have been formulated in a different way just because of our reality and what we see or what we don't see every day as well.
Sure, yeah, either.
I was going to say quickly, to the last part, you know, you're talking about the media and, you know, what all of us learn. I'm not hugely up on current events all the time. I don't constantly look at the internet. But I know almost nothing about Africa, how it is, from the media. I learn everything through human interaction with people who live there or visit there. And or on BBC News. You know, you have to go to foreign news to really learn much. And so I think there's an obvious distinction of the way America treats Africa versus the way it actually is. I think the United States, at least in my view, is the African culture. And so with that, I mean, and maybe this is what, I can't remember the MC that was talking about it.
Chilla.
Right, Chilla. I think with that is something I think African Americans, and I shouldn't generalize, but maybe speaking for myself, just looking that makes more of a disconnect. And it's like, you know, well, you know, in the United States, the media demonizes that culture. And so it's like, I almost don't want to associate myself with that, right? I want to more so associate myself with the American part of my identity, because that part is that's the part of me that's okay. That's the part that's godlike, you know? And so that separates it even further, I think. And I mean, the educational system, you know, all I learned about slavery, it was bad, oh my God, and that was it. I didn't get until I got to Dillard and to Spelman. I didn't know about all these atrocities that happened, right? So, like everybody's been saying, you know, it really needs to be more salty and realizing the fact that culture is demonized.
Zach, yeah.
Yeah. Really kind of going back to what Lisa said, it really does get kind of tricky in terms of just some generalizations. When I was in Namibia last summer, and it was fascinating to see kind of the reverse play out of the critique that was made. I can't remember who.
Shilla.
Okay. We were doing a homestay in right outside of Swakopmund, so on the west side of Namibia. And in our homestay, it's a new setting, so you're trying to find some sense of common ground. People are nervous. It's a new space. And so there were two of us, and the other gentleman that I was with tried to begin a conversation about slavery and trying to find some kind of connections there. And he was extremely frustrated when they had no concept or idea of the history and details that were involved. And so he left that scene very frustrated, very, because he was trying to bridge a gap. Mm-hmm. And we can't assume that everybody has that knowledge, and that, so it really does get tricky.
Yeah, and it's further complexified because the hyperbolic nature of her statement is supplemented with her being in East Africa, right? So the slave trade came from West Africa. And she also, I didn't give much biography, but it's interesting because she's diasporic in the sense that she studied at Valdosta State in computer science and then came back to Kampala to pursue a music career. But all of you are right. I wasn't saying, she's accurate or precise, just simply this is what she said. And it raises a lot of questions, a lot of good ones, I think. So, Lisa?
Mm-hmm. It really pulls into play. Is there a sense of reciprocity there, or should there be a sense of reciprocity? Not that I seek to affirm or negate it. It's just interesting, I think, later discussion. But
yeah, and I tried to turn that on her by saying, "What's your responsibility?" And she saw her own music as somehow addressing that. Yeah, a couple more. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to add real quickly to that. Going one step further with that, what does Africa have to offer the United States in general? We've been talking about, our educational system being sugar-coated. I come from a predominantly white area of the country where, like, the bridge between African-Americans and white people is very bad there. If an African-American walks into the community, they're instantly looked down upon. And I remember having an experience with somebody from Nigeria who walked into that community, and he felt racism, and he could not understand what racism was. In that context. So just taking that back a step, like, I look at what she said, and I say, what does, ultimately, what does Africa have to offer us? What does Africa have to offer us as a country? Because we demonize Africa. The most I know about Africa usually is when CNN plays a clip of Bono talking about why we need to help. It's like almost a three-month rotation. You hear Bono say something, and there's almost a violence in that. Towards Africa, that we kind of just let happen, and you hear that, and then we don't step up and say, what are we going to do about that? So it was very interesting. I was very interested in what she had to say, and just thinking about what does Africa have to offer our country as a whole, not just what do we have in terms of monetary funds to offer Africa.
I just want to make one comment in terms of what she actually said. At the end, she wound around, but she came back and talked about openly about a unity, kind of, that she talked about the importance of African development and so on and so forth. But then at the end, she comes back and she talks about creating a bigger force. And I think she ultimately came back to a place where she was talking about this. All these we do need to come together, and then she made a quasi-theological statement so that we can help to create a bigger force. And she was talking about unity in that context. And so, I do think, I'm not trying to
Well, and she does use the word wholeness. She says something about wanting to create a whole sense of what it means to be black, a comprehensive sense of that. It's 8:30, so
yes.
I'm going to call.
Thanks, Gerald.
Okay.
Thank you.